At first glance, it appeared that Joe Biden, on entering the White House, might take a different approach to arms sales. On the campaign trail in 2020, he had, for instance, labeled Saudi Arabia a pariah state and implied that the unbridled flow of U.S. weaponry to that kingdom would be reduced, if not terminated. He also bluntly assured voters that this country wouldn't check its values at the door to sell arms. Initially, Biden paused arms deals to that country and even suspended one bomb sale. Unfortunately, within 8 months of his taking office, sales to Saudi regime had resumed. In addition, the Biden team has offered arms to a number of other repressive countries, from Egypt to Nigeria and Philippines. Such sales contrast strikingly with the president's mantra of supporting democracies over autocracies, as well as his reasonable impulse to supply weapons to Ukraine. There are numerous examples, both historically and in the present moment, of how this country's arms sales have done more harm than good. But for now, let's just highlight four of them, including Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Nigeria, and the Philippines. Saudi Arabia has spearheaded a horrifying and disastrous 7.5-year-long intervention in Yemen that has killed thousands of people through indiscriminate airstrikes on civilian targets, ranging from hospitals, water treatment plants, and factories to marketplaces, weddings, and even a funeral. In all, that conflict has caused an estimated nearly 400,000 deaths, in large part due to a Saudi-run air and sea blockade that has impeded importing food, medical supplies, and fuel. The overwhelming presence of U.S.-supplied aircraft, bombs, missiles, and other weaponry in that military campaign has led many Yemenis to view it as an American war on their country, sparing resentment and potentially damaging future relations throughout the region. In Yemen, it could help stop the killing tomorrow simply by cutting off arms, spare parts, and help in the maintenance of weapon systems. Such pressure would push the Saudi regime to definitively end its destructive airstrikes and its devastating blockade of that country, while potentially encouraging the launching of good faith negotiations to end the war in Yemen. When it comes to Egypt, the Biden administration has offered more than $6 billion in weaponry so far, including missiles, helicopters, and transport planes. All of that is going to the regime of Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who is widely regarded as the most repressive leader in that country's history. The al-Sisi government has gunned down demonstrators in the street, locked up thousands of political prisoners, and run a scorched-earth counterinsurgency campaign in the northern Sinai Desert that has killed innocent civilians and driven thousands of people from their homes. Last April, the U.S. regime offered attack helicopters worth millions to Nigeria, marking the latest stage in the warming of relations between the two countries that began early in the Trump years. That was $997 million. The Nigerian military, however, has committed torture on a massive scale while targeting thousands of civilians in an ongoing campaign against the terrorist group Boko Haram and its local offshoots. As Human Rights Watch has reported, there is a reasonable basis to believe that Nigerian security forces have committed crimes against humanity, Amnesty International reported that 10,000 civilians died between 2011 and 2020 from extreme neglect in prisons run by Nigeria's military. And far from reducing terrorism, such conduct has further destabilized significant parts of the country, stoking opposition to the government and making it easier for terrorist groups to recruit and operate. Earlier this month, the security situation in Nigeria had deteriorated so badly that Biden administration ordered the family members of U.S. diplomats to leave Abuja, the capital, due to a heightened risk of terrorist attack.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
When former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally pulled out of the Iran deal known as the JCPOA, he also kickstarted his maximum pressure campaign. It essentially entailed exerting as much pressure on Iran through cutting it off from world trade and the global political sphere as much as possible through U.S.'s influence on world bodies, such as the United Nations and the European Union. In the archive of U.S. Department of State, you can see that the foundation of the UN was even based on consolidating U.S. power. It reads, "He, President Roosevelt, felt that this time the United States needed to play a leading role both in the creation of the organization and in the organization itself. This time refers to the post-World War II era." One odd form of influence that the U.S. has in the U.N., for example, is by having essentially three extra votes through an agreement called the Compact of Free Association that makes Micronesia, Marshall Islands, and Palau, all of whom have permanent seats at the U.N., client states that would always vote in favor of U.S. interests. Through this pull, the U.S. has managed to get these world bodies to adopt more sanctions against Iran. Even the IAEA, which has had Iran's full cooperation and transparency over the years, is taking anti-Iran stances as of recently. The U.S. has sanctioned 13 more companies this week that weren't even in Iran. According to U.S. Office of Foreign Assets Control, the aforementioned companies are accused of, quote, facilitating the sale of hundreds of millions of dollars worth of Iranian petrochemicals and petroleum products to buyers in East Asia, and that they were only fronts. Since June, the U.S. has adopted five rounds of designations targeting Iran's petrochemical industry alone. The EU and the UK have also recently added to their sanctions list by putting the names of dozens of individuals and entities on it. A few days ago, they targeted 29 individuals and three entities with asset freezes and travel bans, and in October, when the first batch of new sanctions were introduced, it was 15 individuals and institutions added to the list. In a statement by Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani, he said that Europe's addiction to sanctions has deprived European parties of rationality and tactfulness, tightening the noose on its foreign relations. He further added, "Iran, relying on its national power and making use of its unique experiences in actively dealing with imposed challenges, will take effective countermeasures against such fruitless and unconstructive measures as it did before by upholding its honor and protecting its national interest." Looking at the list of the 30 sanctions regimes that the UN has adopted since 1966, you will almost exclusively see poor African countries as well as Middle Eastern countries with very few exceptions. You will find no country in the Western Bloc. The only European country on the list is former Yugoslavia, which wasn't even considered as the West when it wasn't former Yugoslavia. This means that there has been no sin big enough on the West's record to warrant any sanctions against it. Neither the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan by US and NATO, nor the Saudi coalition's war in Yemen, nor the unwavering support of the US for Israel's decades of violating Palestinians' rights, or the Libyan coup staged by the West. And certainly not funding Persian-speaking channels to call for riots and violence in the streets of Iran, as well as platforming numerous separatist groups and organizations. The excuses found during the past weeks to exert even more pressure on Iran has been growing, from US Navy's claims that Iran was trying to smuggle 70 tons of missile fuel to Yemen, or an attack on an Israeli billionaire's oil tanker off the coast of Oman, both of which Iran rejects having a part in. The so-called world body's conduct seems to have only benefited a unipolar Western agenda, an agenda increasingly questioned and increasingly under threat. In order to keep the crumbling American hegemony, though, the US and its allies must shut down opposition through any means necessary, even if it means championing human rights and then calling for immunity for Mohammed bin Salman following revelations of his direct involvement in the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Even if U.S. President formerly vowed to make Saudi Arabia pay for the crime.
With respect to the murder of Khashoggi, I raised it at the top of the meeting, making it clear what I thought of it at the time and what I think of it now. And it was exactly, I was straightforward and direct in discussing it. I made my view crystal clear. I said very straightforwardly, for an American president to be silent on an issue of human rights, is this inconsistent with who we are and who I am? I'll always stand up for our values. We are going to hold them accountable for human rights abuses.
Iran is an obstacle in the way of U.S. hegemony and domination in the region. The failed maximum pressure campaign is America's attempt at clutching to its imperialist adventures. How long will it be able to keep up the act, however, is the question.
For weeks, Iran has witnessed unrest and riots in its different cities. The unrest started after a young woman named Mahsa Amini fainted in police custody and later died in hospital. The protests were initially peaceful, but violent elements supported by Western spy agencies hijacked the protests and turned into violent riots. The unrest has provided a fertile ground for Western governments and spy agencies to launch a media warfare on Iran and create anti-Iran fake news. A recent notorious case in point is the recent tweet by Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. In the controversial tweet, the Canadian Premier had claimed that Iran has sentenced 15,000 protesters to death. The false claim, which has been part of the media campaign against Iran, has been circulating on social media in recent days. The inaccurate tweet was live on Trudeau's official Twitter account for almost 12 hours before it was deleted. Several Western celebrities and news outlets, including the Newsweek, also shared the erroneous information. This is not the only case of false news propagated against Iran. When the protests first started in Iran, Western-backed propaganda outlets claimed that Mahsa Amini was beaten to death by Iranian police forces. Following an elaborate investigation, that claim also proved to be false. It's now become a common practice for these propaganda machines to publish unverified footages on protests in Iran. Back in September 2022, US media outlets ran a controversial report. The report was widely discussed and celebrated in anti-Iran outlets. But it turned out to be a fake report after Ayatollah Khamenei publicly attended a military ceremony in Tehran in October. The false report was propagated by Western outlets as Iran was battling the Western-backed riots. Social media platforms have also turned into a battleground of narratives against Iran. Analysis shows those tweeting the hashtags associated with the unrest showed a striking number of new accounts created since the protests started.
in August 2011, when there were riots in London because someone was shot and killed by the police, a number of people were killed. I don't recall the exact number. But big tech, Facebook, back then BlackBerry, and Twitter cooperated with the British government. In the case of Iran, big tech is used as a weapon against Iranians. So Iranian voices don't come out. Iranians lose their, if they are opposed to the Western narrative, they get sanctioned. All of the Iranian media is sanctioned. Many individuals have lost their accounts. I have lost my Facebook and Instagram accounts. So these Western big tech companies, they cooperate with Western governments, even though in the riots in London, people were killed, and they arrested people and put them in jail for inciting riots. But in Iran, these same media outlets make threats, they support, they help people make Molotov cocktails, and they help mobilize the rioters.
The online anti-Iran campaign is fed by fake accounts used by members of the anti-Iran Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization terrorist cult who are stationed in Albania and so-called journalists employed by the Saudi-funded London-based Iran International TV, which is now on Tehran's terror blacklist. The television channel has openly been promoting monarchists, the highly notorious MKO terror group, and most significantly, separatist terrorists. A particular case in point is a project by Western media outlets to accuse the government of killing its own citizens. They have produced a long list of citizens which they claim have been killed by security forces.
Iran has witnessed another deadly terrorist attack. The latest deadly incident happened in the city of Izeh in Iran's southwestern province of Khuzestan. Unidentified gunmen opened fire on civilians and security forces, killing several people, including a child and an elderly woman. The terror attack also left a number of people injured. No group has yet claimed responsibility for the assault. President Ebrahim Raisi has condoled with the families of the victims, ordering security officials to identify and bring to justice all terrorists behind the attack. The senior judicial official says three people who were behind the brutal attack were arrested. The special operation is going on to identify and to bring to justice other people involved in the attack in the city of Izeh. Separately, a religious seminary school in the Izeh city was set ablaze by a group of rioters. No one was injured in that incident. Separately, three people were killed and eight security forces injured during riots in Semirom in the central Iranian province of Isfahan. Two security forces also killed and two others wounded in the city of Malikshahr in Isfahan province. Last month, a terrorist attack happened in the city of Shiraz. On October 26th, a terrorist attacked the popular Shia shrine of Shah Cheragh in Iran's southwestern province of Fars, killing over a dozen people. That attack was claimed by the Daesh terrorist group. The attacks come amid ongoing foreign-backed riots that have hit various Iranian provinces after a 22-year-old Kurdish woman named Mahsa Amini died in the hospital despite intensive medical care and resuscitation efforts. The rioters have been going on a rampage across the country, attacking security officers, resorting to vandalism against public property, and desecrating religious sanctities. Iran says the attacks are part of a larger plot to destabilize the country. Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian says security services, the Israeli regime, and certain Western politicians are conspiring to trigger a civil war in Iran to destroy and to disintegrate the country. He warned them that Iran is not Libya or Sudan. He also noted that the enemies are targeting Iran's territorial integrity and identity, saying that Iran will not allow anyone to jeopardize national security. The terrorist attack comes amid Western attempts to stoke unrest in Iran and to create more economic hardships for the Iranian people. Late last month, Iran's main intelligence bodies reported that the U.S., backed by the U.K., Saudi Arabia, Israel, and other allies, are devising a multidimensional plot for instigating riots in the Islamic Republic and directing the wave of violence.
We are telling our enemies, the U.S., Britain, the Saudis, these are the ones that, through their destructive media outlets, they are targeting our revolution. We are warning them that we will break you, we will crush you, you will not find any way into this territory.
Western countries expressed their open support for rioters and acts that Tehran described as inciting violence and hatred. The European Union and some Western countries have imposed sanctions on Iran over its approach toward the recent riots. Recently, the former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton confirmed that subversive groups in Iran, which he characterized as the opposition, are being armed with weapons imported from Iraq's Kurdistan.
United States should take history as a mirror and let it guide the future. That's what the Chinese President Xi Jinping told his American counterpart Joe Biden on the sidelines of the Group of 20 summit in Bali, Indonesia.
As always, I'm ready to have a candid and in-depth exchange of views with Mr. President on issues of strategic importance in China-US relations and major global and regional issues at our meeting today. I also look forward to working with you to bring China-US relations back to the track of healthy and stable development.
We share a responsibility, in my view, to show that China and the United States can manage our differences, prevent competition from becoming anything ever near conflict, and to find ways to work together on urgent global issues that require our mutual cooperation.
The two held their first ever in-person meeting as relations between Washington and Beijing are at their lowest in decades, marred by disagreements over a host of issues from Taiwan to trade. During the landmark three-hour meeting, the Chinese president warned his U.S. counterpart not to cross Beijing's red line over Taiwan. According to the Chinese state media, Xi stressed that Taiwan is the bedrock of the political foundation of bilateral relations. Biden, for his part, said the U.S. wants to manage differences with China to prevent competition from becoming conflict. Biden said he sought to assure Xi that U.S. policy on Taiwan has not changed, seeking to lower tensions over the self-ruled island.
And I do not think there's any imminent attempt on the part of China to invade Taiwan. And I made it clear that our policy on Taiwan has not changed at all. It's the same exact position we've had. I made it clear that we want to see cross-strait issues peacefully resolved.
On North Korea, Biden told Xi that Beijing has an obligation to attempt to talk Pyongyang out of conducting a seventh nuclear test. U.S.-China relations have been strained in recent years by growing tensions over issues ranging from Taiwan to the South China Sea, trade practices and U.S. restrictions on Chinese technology. Regarding Taiwan, Beijing says it's a matter for the Chinese and China's internal affair. Anyone that seeks to split Taiwan from China will be violating the fundamental interests of the Chinese nation. Tensions over the self-ruled island have intensified following a provocative visit there in August by the U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi. The move prompted large-scale Chinese military drills around the island territory as well as a declaration by the U.S. President Joe Biden to defend Taiwan. Beijing has time and again slammed U.S. provocations, including encouraging and supporting pro-separatist independence forces on the island, saying that Washington has no right to interfere in how to resolve the Taiwan issue. Also, Biden dropped the hammer on China's semiconductor industry by fully implementing a slew of tough controls on the export of American chip technology to China. It would also undermine China's ability to import, manufacture, and export the semiconductors that run the world. The goal was to slow down and prevent Chinese military and technological advances. Washington also takes sides with Beijing's rivals in a maritime dispute in the South China Sea by routinely sending warships and warplanes to the waters to assert what it calls its right to freedom of navigation. China has repeatedly called on Washington to stop the provocative actions, which undermine peace and stability in the strategic waters. Last month, the White House and the Pentagon declared Beijing as Washington's most serious strategic competitor, in reports outlining U.S. defense and foreign policy strategies. Therefore, despite Biden's meeting with Xi, can the two manage their differences to prevent conflict, or is it inevitable that the two are on the collision course?
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
KRIB English Radio.
بسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا.
قد دعوتك ربي بقرآني جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفرانك يا من ينجينا إحسان. ودعوتك ربي بقرآني.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. اللهم صل على محمد وآله الطاهرين.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وأجل فرج.
Respected brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah and welcome to Let's Recite the Quran Kareem, a series of Quranic sessions held by IRIB English Radio in cooperation with Sevier International Schools Network. I really welcome you all, and also our brothers from Sevier International School. Welcome Fawad Haider and Salamun Alaikum.
Salam, thank you, sir.
Are
How
you good?
Are you?
Alhamdulillah, yes. Thank you so much. And brother Ali Nasser?
Alhamdulillah, sir.
Great, that's great. So, brothers and sisters, thank you so much once again for joining us. So, Ali Nasser and Fawad Haider, today inshallah we'll be working on Ayah 111 of Surah Al-Baqarah. Okay, we'll have a short explanation, the same as our previous sessions that our brothers and sisters know. And then, inshallah, the tajweed rules, inshallah, practically will apply on this ayah. Make sure, inshallah, brothers and sisters who are listening to us, to stay with us till the end of this session. Before we go and start, let's listen to the recitation of this ayah once all together. Great. Thank you so much. Allah bless the Qari, inshallah, the reciter. Now, I'll be reciting, inshallah. Make sure you repeat after me. Brothers and sisters who are listening to us, please make sure you have your Quran with you. Ayah 110 of Surah Al-Baqarah. Listen, please, and repeat and practice after us.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
وقالوا لن يدخل الجنة إلا من كان هودا أو نصارى
وقالوا لن يدخل الجنة إلا من كان هودا أو نصارى
تلك أمانيهم
تلك أمانيهم
قل هاتوا برهانكم إن كنتم صادقين
قل هاتوا برهانكم إن كنتم صادقين.
أحسنتم. Thank you so much. From now, I'm asking our friends, okay, who are listening to us, to stay with us in this session, also in the coming session, inshallah, okay? that will explain the next verses of Surah Al-Baqarah as well. So, in this ayah, Allah Almighty says, وَقَالُوا Allah Almighty says that the Jewish people and the Christians, okay, they say that لَنْ يَدْخُلَ الْجَنَّةِ No one shall enter paradise except one who is a Jew or a Christian. The Jews and the Christians, they believe, they say it, okay? That no one shall enter paradise except the one who is a Jew or a Christian. They were saying this. Allah Almighty says, تِلْكَ أَمَانِيُّهُمْ Those are their false hopes. Allah Almighty says, those are their false hopes. Things that they wish for, false ones, okay? And they are not the right thing. Inshallah, the next ayah, Allah Almighty says that who will enter paradise. Then Allah Almighty says, if you believe so, قُلْ O Prophet, say to them, هَاتُوا بُرْهَانَكُمْ produce your evidence. Show us, prove it. Give us a reason that you say that nobody enters, no Muslims enter, nobody else, except the one who is a Jew or a Christian. So it means that if anyone wants to be if anybody wants to enter paradise, he has to be either a Jew or a Christian. Allah Almighty says, "Hatu burhanakum." Prove it. While in your books, while in the Torah, while in the Bible, it has been mentioned who enters. Not only Jews and Christians. Inshallah, in the next slide, we'll talk about it. قُلْ هَاتُوا بُرْهَانَكُمْ إِن كُنْتُمْ صَادِقِينَ If you are true, if you're right, bring us some reasons. Give us some reasons, right? So, what does it say? That it says that whatever someone talks to you, either it's in terms of belief, okay? He says that God does not exist. You have to ask him. Come on, prove it. If you say that God exists, okay, you prove it, right? So anything someone wants to tell you about beliefs, you have to ask them for reasons, okay? So if something is very clear, logical, clear, rational, so it doesn't need, if it's so clear for you, okay? Because if you know, it's okay. But if you don't know something, so you see that it might be kind of tricky, you ask them for reasons, right? Especially in terms of something which is religious. Be so much careful, okay? Do not listen to anyone about things which are related to religion, okay? Ask them. Okay, we have hadith that says that don't look at someone who says, don't look at what they say. In terms of religion, this is different. You have to look at who says this and what do they say, right? And also ask them for reasons. If they are talking this way, ask them for reasons. So, inshallah, please refer to the Tafasir book interpretations, okay, from our shuyukh, our mufassirin, inshallah, and you'll study more about these verses. قرآني نبض حياتي قرآني طهر ذاتي قرآني عصمة أمري قرآني طوق نجاتي قرآني نبض حياتي How to learn Quran easy? What is the correct way to read the Quran? What is the correct way to learn Arabic and understand the Quran? Be with Let's Recite the Quran. Now, our main topic, Fawad Haider, which is the Tajweed rules. Let's practice, inshallah. وَقَالُوا قَالُوا Heavy letter. And لُو Also a vowel, right? Long vowel. Make sure you pronounce them correctly. وَقَالُوا How, Ali Nasir?
وَقَالُوا
أحسن قَالُوا Do not say قَالُوا Because قَاف is a heavy letter. قَالُوا Right. لن يدخل الجنة لن يدخل نون ساكين But the rule says that if you have a نون ساكين plus يا what should you do? Huh?
You should do إدغام?
Yeah, you should apply إدغام What does إدغام say, Ali Nasir?
So we should merge the Nuna Sakin with Ya.
Merge it. It means you gotta kind of double the Ya. Because when you merge, Nun changes to the Ya sound. Lay. Lay. Yad. Hulal Jannah. Right? You mix them together. Lay. Yad. Hulal Jannah. One more thing. You do this merging, okay? You insert the Nun sound to the Ya sound and changes to Ya sound. But is it with a nasal sound or without a nasal sound? It with Gunna or without?
With Gunna.
With Gunna. Look, nasal sound. There is a nasal sound. You hear it. You do not see it, you hear it. Right? يدخل الجنة. There is one more rule. Can you infer what the rule says? What's the rule here?
قلقلة.
The rule قلقلة. Bouncing sound. Where?
يد.
With the letter dal, which is ساكين. So five letters were there. Can you say them, Fawad? Five letters were there, which if they are ساكين, okay, they must be producing a bouncing sound. Tickle them, okay? A little قاف. Jump. قاف.
طا.
طا.
ب.
ب.
جيم دال.
جيم جا. دال. If you put them together, Ali Nasir?
قطب جد. قطب جد.
Remember these words. Two words. قطب جد. قطب جد. These five letters. قاف. طا. با. جيم دال. If they are ساكين, the rule of تجويد says you must produce a bouncing sound while pronouncing them. Right? Because they don't have any harakat, so you read them with the previous harakat, and you have to bounce the sound as well. Lay yad, tickle it. Yad, right? Yad khul al jannah, right? Next one, yad khul al jannah, nun. Okay, nun mushaddad. Make sure you produce a bouncing. Not a bouncing sound, nasal sound. Okay, jannah. Also, idgham mithlain. Jannah. Right? Mushad. Next one. Jannata illa man kana hudan aw nasara. Man kana. Nun sakin plus kaf. The rule says if there is a nun sakin plus kaf, fa, qaf, dal, dal,
ikhfa,
za, sin, sheen. What is the rule? Ikhfa. And the rest of the letters? There are 13 letters. So, this group of letters.
Ikhfa.
Ikhfa, the rule ikhfa. You hide the sound of the letter nun. Right? And also, because there is the letter kaf, you make sure that your listener should kind of understand, okay? That there is the letter kaf coming after this nun sakin. Mank.
Yeah.
Ink. Mank. This. Bank. Yes? Ank sound. Man kana, right? Man kana. There's a nasal sound as well. So, hudan aw nasara. Hudan, tanween plus hamza. Hamzatul qata'. It's not hamzatul wasl, so you should skip it. Hamzatul qata'. So you gotta pronounce it. Right? Hudan. So, what does the rule say?
So no rule applied.
The rule says that if there are six letters after the tanween or nun sakin, there is no rule applied. Yes? Which six letters? That's
Ayn,
a funny rule.
Ayn.
Ayn. Ghain.
Ha.
Ha. Ha.
Ha.
Kha. Hamza. The six letters. So it means you normally read it. Hudan aw nasara. As if you don't know no tajweed rules. Hudan aw nasara. So, there is a stopping sign. Make sure you stop. Stopping is better because it is qala, right? Or qali. So, now, قُلْ تِلْكَ أَمَانِيُّهُمْ. Again, make sure you stop it here. It's better to stop, okay? قُلْ هَاتُوا بُرْهَانَكُمْ. There is no special rule. All are easy. بُرْ, only ra, ikhfa, no, sorry. تَفْخِيمُ الرَّا, or heavily pronounce it. بُرْهَانَكُمْ. In kuntum sadiqin. In nun sakin plus kaf. Ikhfa. Again, the same as man kana. Make sure the nun is making it clear that the kaf is coming after it. In kuntum sadiqin. That's it. So let's listen with tajweed rules to this ayah. Thank you so much. That was great. Alhamdulillah. I hope you practice, inshallah. Make sure for the explanations. Once again, please refer to the Tafasir book and interpretations of our Mufassirin. Inshallah, you will understand more. Thank you so much. Allah bless you. Any question, Ali Nasser and Fawad?
No.
No. Brothers and sisters, if you had any questions, you can message us, inshallah. Thank you so much. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammadin wa alihi al-tahirin.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وأجل فرجه.
Let's recite the Quran, a joint production of IRIB English Radio and Xavier International Schools.
ذكر وموعظة ونور فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نرقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان والقرآن.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
They're back as India has released several of them into the grasslands of Kuna National Park after a 70-year absence in the country. The eight radio-coloured African cheetahs made the long journey from Namibia. The big cats were released during a ceremony by Prime Minister Narendra Modi that coincided with his birthday. After their acclimation in the national park, they will be released into a 5-hectare spread of land in central India covered by grassland and forest. The felines will share the landscape with other animals and roam with leopards, sloths and striped hyenas. Their reintroduction is the culmination of a 13-year effort to restore the species which vanished from the country decades ago. Another 12 cheetahs are expected to join the fledgling Indian population next month from South Africa. With more funding, the country hopes to gradually increase the population of cheetahs to around 40. After repeated failed attempts, NASA has eventually launched this moon rocket on its debut flight. NASA's next-generation moon rocket blasted off from Florida, marking the start of the space agency's new program dubbed Artemis. An uncrewed Orion spaceship is fixed to the top of the 32-story tall Space Launch System rocket. It will be separated for a 25-day voyage around the moon and back without astronauts abroad. It was the third time after two previous launch attempts were cancelled for technical reasons. If the mission succeeds, a crewed Artemis II will orbit around the moon but not land on the surface in 2024. The third Artemis mission, scheduled for 2025, will be the first to put astronauts on the moon since Apollo's mission about 5 decades ago.
Iran has hosted an international student scientific contest dubbed Noor or Light. The annual event seeks to promote science among children and scout for child prodigies. Yusuf Jalali has the story.
They have only 1 minute to present a scientific idea in their homemade clips. Over 1,300 teenage science enthusiasts from 19 countries participated in Iran's Noor competition, a scientific contest for school students. The fifth edition of the event was themed with optical illusion and mathematical modeling. The top 100 videos were awarded during this closing ceremony. in Tehran.
My work is titled The Bouncing Ball. We painted a long oval and a shadow under it. When we film it from a certain angle, it takes the shape of a levitating ball.
Our work is about an optical illusion. We created a set of conjoining cylinders that appeared to change shape in the mirror. The idea was first created by a Japanese engineer in 2016.
The most creative videos win the prize. They should be both educational and mind-blowing, like this floating Rubik's Cube, which appears to be levitating, but then turns out to be just an origami work.
We have two levels of the competition. One is the kind of general competition for the crowd, and many students can contribute on that, in that. And we have other level, which is for elites. And in that level, we have more sophisticated competition between elite.
Organizers say participants in newer contests are not supposed to make breakthroughs. The main goal, they say, is to engage them in science and let them experience the excitement of scientific experiments.
Try to make these teenagers learn how they can think about science for the welfare of human beings and how they can apply it for them.
Mustafa Science and Technology Foundation is the organizer of this scientific event. The foundation also holds the biennial Mustafa Prize, which awards cash prizes to top scientists from across the Muslim world, whose accomplishments contribute to the welfare of human beings.
Mustafa Science and Technology Foundation, as the organizer of Noor Competition, says prodigies are everywhere. They just need to be discovered. It says this contest is a platform that's specially designed to scout for teenage minds and give them a chance to shine. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Chinese aerobatic teams have been performing jaw-dropping stunts to mark the 73rd anniversary of the People's Liberation Army Air Force. Pilots wowed the audience with their complicated maneuvers, such as swooping close to the ground, making loops and rolls. Aerobatic teams use red, yellow and blue smoke trails representing the flag of the Chinese Air Force. The Hongying aerobatic team, also known as the Red Eagle, is made up of 10 JL-8 trainer planes and 20 pilots from the Air Force Aviation University. The performance was part of China's International Aviation and Aerospace Exhibition held in southern China. The exhibit typically draws thousands of participants in the field of aviation from countries all over the world. Iran is the land of saffron, and the red gold has earned the country a fortune throughout the centuries. Now Iran's city of Torbat Haydariya has hosted a saffron photography festival as a means to introduce the lucrative product to the world. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Like gold, it is weighed in shekels, not in kilos. And that's why saffron is called the red gold, reflecting how precious it is economically. Torbat Haydariya in northeast Iran is the hub of saffron cultivation in the country, producing an average of 20 million tons of the crop each year. Now the city hosts the Festival of Saffron Photography every year to introduce Iran as the land of saffron and how these hard-working farmers produce the strategic crop.
Photographers present in this festival should use their artistry to shed light on different stages of saffron harvest all the way to the final product. Everyone knows Iranian saffron, but perhaps few know how it's produced. So this festival highlights this issue using photography.
Photography is a universal language that needs no translation, so their photos can better introduce this strategic plan to the world from unique angles.
This year, Iran exported roughly 300 tons of saffron, generating more than $350 million in income, according to the data provided by the Ministry of Agriculture. Experts believe Iran could have a much higher share of the global trade of saffron if it pays better attention to branding and marketing of the product.
Due to favorable weather conditions, Iranian saffron is unique in the world. But unfortunately, in many countries, it's smuggled in bulk and is packaged under foreign brands and then sold at higher prices. If we can brand it inside Iran, then we can export it more efficiently.
The young farm owner says his saffron is exported to Europe and the Middle East, despite the restrictions caused by U.S. sanctions on Iran. But more than the U.S. measures, he's concerned about the impact of climate change on saffron cultivation, warning of what he calls saffron immigration from his city, if authorities remain idle.
Unfortunately, saffron is gradually leaving our region and moving to western parts of Iran. This is due to changes in weather conditions and declining rainfall here. If the government helps farmers with modification of planting patterns, we can stop this disaster.
Over the past 2 years, Iran has expanded its cultivation area for saffron to 115,000 hectares, nearly 20 times more than the entire worldwide land dedicated to the crop. While the Iranian red gold is mainly cultivated in the northeastern Khorasan province, other parts of the country, including Khuzestan and Chaharmahal Bakhtiari, are also fertile for saffron farming.
For centuries, saffron has been a key word in Iran's economy, and still is today. Now, Saffron Photography Festival says many know Iran by its red gold, but through the photos shot here, they will get a glimpse of the mesmerizing saffron farms in Iran and how this amazing crop is produced. Yusuf Jalali from the saffron farms in the suburbs of Turbat Haydariye.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Usually, rats are associated with garbage and disease, but these rats are not the typical rodents. They are being trained in Tanzania for search and rescue operations. These are a breed called the African giant pouch rat, which is naturally a very curious creature. It can weigh up to around 1,500 grams and are known to have longer lifespans than other rats. Lead researcher at the Belgium-based non-profit company Apopo, Donna Keane, says this species can live up to 10 years. This means that even after the 9 months of training, the rat will still have a long working career ahead. The size and agility of rats make them invaluable for search and rescue efforts.
So this is where the idea for the rats came in, because the rats are just as trainable as dogs. They've got a great sense of smell, and their small size and natural agility should hopefully make them really good in this scenario where they could squeeze in small spaces and get closer to any victims.
The rescue rats began training in August last year at the Apopo's Training and Research Center. The rodents are fitted with tiny backpacks that enable real-time wireless audio-visual communication. When they find a potential victim, they pull a small handle hanging around their neck to let the rescue handlers know. The rats were trained to locate humans in mock disaster zones, such as aftermath of earthquakes. Apopo has already trained rats to detect landmines and sniff out tuberculosis. So much joy can be found in a bottle of luxury perfume, but parting with hundreds of dollars for such scents, I can take the shine off that experience. Now in Syria, a perfumer is helping people smell expensive without digging too deep into their pockets. One whiff of a fragrance is all a Syrian perfumer needs to recreate the scents of luxury brands for a fraction of a cost. That's very welcome in a country ravaged by years of foreign-backed militancy. Dozens of customers flock daily to his tiny store nestled in the historic bazaar of Damascus. They flash photos on their phones of high-end perfumes they want to replicate. He says all he has is his nose.
Here lies the secret of the profession and the brain power. I started training my nose to smell perfumes since I was 15 years old. I do not own high-end equipment. All I have is my nose, my brain power and expertise. That's all.
In the war-torn country, many people struggle to afford life's bare necessities, let alone perfume. With the local currency losing much of its value, Syrian employees reportedly make roughly $25 a month, on average a quarter of the price of a bottle of imported perfume. This perfumer sells his fragrances for about $6, drawing in a flow of clients from all walks of life. Some people believe the internet will soon make paper books a thing of the past. In Iraq, book lovers are fighting back. They have launched a book festival offering thousands of free books to encourage the Arab nation to read more. The festival is called Iraq Reads. It's attracted big crowds. Iraqis stood shoulder to shoulder behind long tables covered in books and flipped through hundreds of titles to find the one catching their interest. Some others gather on next to the stands to read under a tree, chat about their newest books, or listen to extracts of literature read aloud through a loudspeaker. One of the organizers says they aim to revive the culture of reading books, reading paper books.
It's a crisis all over the world, not only in Iraq. There is a crisis in terms of reading paper books. One of the goals for our festival is to revive the reading of paper books so that the electronic book does not become an alternative of the paper book.
As part of the festival, 70,000 books have been distributed for free across the country so far. The books covering a wide range of topics were donated by partner libraries. The festival is held in 7 provinces in the Arab country.
IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.